which is narrated in Sahih Muslim from Zayd ibn Arqam. If you go to that hadith, which is narrated in Sahih Muslim, you see that in that hadith, at the end of that hadith, the Holy Prophet wasallam says, "Udhakkirukum bi ahli bayti, udhakkirukum bi ahli bayti, udhakkirukum bi ahli bayti." Three times in that hadith of Ghadir, which is narrated by the Sunni narrators, and it is accepted worldwide by all Muslims as the true hadith accepted. In this hadith, again, we see that the Holy Prophet always, and particularly in his last Hajj in Ghadir Khum, he emphasized and overemphasized by three times repeatedly mentioning Ahl al-Bayt.
Yes.
You know why? Why is it so much important to follow Ahl al-Bayt? Later, when the event of Ashura happened, then the people understood that, okay, why did the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam always tell us that inni tarikun fikum al-thiqlain kitab Allah wa itrati ahli bayti.
Yes.
Udhakkirukum bi ahli bayti. Every day he went to the house of Lady Zahra sallallahu alaihi, practically showed the people, calling them that these are my ahli bayt, and you have to follow them and you have not to forget them. Why? Because unfortunately, after the demise of the Holy Prophet, what happened, as you asked rightly, was this, that some of the people went astray. They were misguided by some of the people, particularly by the Amawid, let's say, figures, personalities. That is why Abu Abdullah والسلام, and Amir al-Mu'mineen and Lady Zahra عليها, and Imam Hassan, they unfortunately, they did not, the people, majority of the people, unfortunately, did not refer to these people, whom were introduced the best source of Islam, the most perfect source for Islamic teachings by the Holy Prophet himself. So that's why what happened was this, that unfortunately, the true teachings of Islam, the true message of Islam, were not conveyed to the people. For example, if I want to mention, is this, that if you refer to, if you study, if our brothers and sisters, the audience, if they go to the history and just read the event, then the reports and the accounts of Ashura from both Sunni and Shia sources, without any kind of bias, or let's say without
prejudice.
Any kind of prejudice, yeah.
Yes.
If they look at this event as a kind of independent figure, as a kind of person who is indifferent towards these kind of issues, you see that in Karbala, what we do not see is akhlaq,
yes,
is morality, is ethical and moral teachings of Islam. It was completely destroyed. It was completely forgotten by the people of Yazid, by the army of Yazid in Karbala. So while Islam is a religion of peace, a religion of akhlaq, a religion of morality, a religion of ethical kind of teachings and doctrine, but unfortunately we do not see any sign of akhlaq, any sign of, let's say, morality in the event of Ashura. So it shows that in that site in which the army of Yazid were, there were no Islam actually. We do not see Islam. We do not see any kind of basic and fundamental teachings of Islam, particularly moral and akhlaqi kind of teachings of Islam. So that's why, and also what Yazid did with the Ummah, with the nation, what later the other Amawid caliphs and Marwani caliphs did with the Ummah and the nation, which led to the uprisal of all the Ummah, all Muslims against them, particularly by the by Qiyam, or the revolt of, let's say, Abu Muslim Khurasani, and
yes,
who toppled down, for example, collapsed the Amawid regime. So it showed that Muslim nation, Muslim Ummah later understood that this Amawid, caliphate, Amawid kingdom, is totally opposed to the true teachings of Islam.
Yes.
To the true teachings of Ahl al-Bayt, alayhi salatu wassalam. It was the reason that Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam, Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba, Imam al-Baqir, Imam al-Sadiq, all the A'imma alayhi salatu wassalam, tried their best to perform Amr bi-Ma'ruf and Nahi an al-Munkar, to remind always the Muslim nation,
yes,
that you have to follow the true Islam, not this Islam that is being spreaded and propagated or preached by, for example, the Amawid kingdom. It's not the true Islam. Yeah, this was the reason that,
yes,
Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam let's say, sacrificed his yes. life for the sake of Amr ibn Ma'ruf.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir. Praises to Allah, all glories to Allah, we
worship Allah and no one but Allah. Yeah, even in the speeches of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, there is a famous sentence that إِنَّمَا خَرَجْتُ لَتَلَبِ إِصْلَاحِ فِي أُمَّةِ جَدِّي. Okay, so doing إِصْلَاح or the correction in the behavior of the Ummah of Rasulullah was the main cause. And then said, أَنْ أَمُرَ بِالْمَعْرُوفِ وَأَنْحَ عَنِ الْمُنْكَرِ. So in his letter also to the heads of the tribes and the other people, he always invited the people to كَتَابَ اللَّهِ وَسُنَّةُ النَّبِي. We can say سُنَّةُ أُمَّةِ and the other things. And this correction of the behaviors of the people on that time, 61 years, you know, is not so many years, Shaykh, for a tribe to be deviated from the right path. So what happened during the years by the kings, and this shows that when a fasiq king is ruling over an Islamic land, it can deviate all the people from the right path.
Of course, you know, when Muawiyah came to the power, first Muawiyah signed an agreement, a peace agreement, peace treaty with Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wasalam. But in that agreement, there were specific articles to which both sides were, let's say, dedicated and were adhered to. But unfortunately, later, Muawiyah completely changed his position. Changed his, let's say, view and totally behaved Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba and the followers of him opposed to what he signed in that agreement with Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wassalam. So for example, one of the things in that agreement was this, that you should never curse Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. But later, unfortunately, in Medina, in the presence of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wassalam, the people of Muawiyah cursed Amir al-Mu'mineen. And then he was not allowed to appoint anyone as his successor, but he practically appointed Yazid as his successor. So unfortunately, he violated all those things that he signed with Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salatu wassalam, and then started bombarding Amir al-Mu'mineen, Imam Hassan, and Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, with their, let's say, preachers, with their propagators, and they did not allow Imam Hassan alayhi salatu wassalam, did not allow Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam to spread the teachings of Islam. You see, if you go to the sources, the Sunni sources, you find very few hadiths from Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein.
Yes.
While they were the closest companions of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, you know why? What is the reason? The reason is this, that the Amavid kingdom and caliphate did not allow the people to go to Ahlul Bayt, to go to Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein. That's why they did not have any chance to spread the teachings of Islam, the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, to the people. And it was only the preachers, the propagators of Amavid regime, who were always, every day, every now and then, here and there, try to just propagate the teachings of the school of Amawites.
Yes.
So that's why it influenced the people.
Yes.
Later we see that some of the people who were among the followers of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, but later they stood against Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam.
Yes.
It was the influence and the effect of, let's say, propagation of the regime against Ahl al-Bayt.
Shamr ibn Zil-Jawshan was one of them.
Shamr ibn Zil-Jawshan, he was with Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam. But under the influences of this kind of propagation, yeah. later he changed his mindset.
Even on the night of Tashu'a and Ashura, their different letters were sent
to
the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, to Hazrat Abu'l-Fazl, to Imam Hussein himself, that let's change, for example, your goal of Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahya al-Munkar with money, power, territories and different things. You know, but Imam never paid allegiance to a person like Yazid.
But of course, we have to mention also the companions of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, like, for example, Habib ibn Mazahir, who was an old man.
Mm-hmm.
He secretly escaped from the Kufa, to support Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam, and he fought against the people. And also, we can mention Hur ibn Yazid al-Riyahi, who converted to Imam Hussein, who also changed his mindset and came to Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam. So, of course, we have these examples as well, that they stood, on their firm belief and supported Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam. Of course, there were also some people who, maybe because of the worldly and earthly kind of interests, benefits, and they followed, for example, Yazid, as for Umar al-Sa'd, it's mentioned in the history that he wanted to become a governor of Ray. He was for the sake of becoming a ruler or governor in Ray, the city in nowadays Iran. That's why he fought against Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam. That was the reason. So, of course, unfortunately, because of those earthly and worldly kind of interests and benefits, some of the people changed their mindset and followed the other side against Imam Hussein alayhi wasalam.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Do not forget in your du'as and supplications on the sessions and the majalis that you attend during the holy months of Muharram, during the months of Muharram, especially on the days of Tashu'a and Ashura. Do not forget to visit our website too at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min labani aliyin wa husayin wa hasan. لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن إن في الجنة نهراً من لبن لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن لعليٍ وحسينٍ وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
In the limelight.
U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says Republican lawmakers may consider an impeachment inquiry of President Joe Biden over charges of financial misconduct. Responding to enormous Republican pressure to demonstrate support for Donald Trump ahead of the 2024 presidential election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy said an impeachment investigation should be opened into President Joe Biden after Republican-run committees heard charges the Bidens peddled their influence and weaponized the government. Kevin McCarthy said on Monday, 24th of July, on Fox's Sean Hannity show, he said, "This is rising to the level of impeachment inquiry, which provides Congress the strongest power to get the rest of the knowledge and information needed." Kevin McCarthy added, "Because this president has also used something we have not seen since Richard Nixon, use of weaponization of government to benefit his family and deny Congress the ability to have the oversight." Two committees, House Oversight and Ways and Means Committees, have heard charges about Hunter Biden's business dealings and say that Joe Biden was involved in his son's schemes, something the White House has always denied. On Monday night, Kevin McCarthy said there was sufficient concerning charges to warrant an impeachment investigation. McCarthy said when Biden was running for office, he told the public he has never talked about business. He said his family has never received a dollar from China, which we prove is not true. The Speaker of the House added, "We're only followed where the information has taken us." In response, the White House accused House Republicans of failing to focus on important issues. Ian Sams, White House spokesperson for Oversight and Investigations, tweeted, "Instead of focusing on the real issues the American people want us to address, like continuing to lower inflation or to create jobs, this is what the House GOP wants to prioritize." Ian Sams added, "Their eagerness to go after the President of the United States, regardless of the truth, is seemingly bottomless." Kevin McCarthy's comments came as the House Oversight Committee is in its final week of hearings before the summer break. They're hoping to hear from Hunter Biden's former business associate and friend, Devon Archer, who will reportedly testify that Hunter Biden would regularly call his then-vice president father during meetings. Devon Archer, a 48-year-old, was subpoenaed on 12th of June by the House Oversight Committee, which is investigating Hunter Biden's businesses and whether he and other members of the Biden family improperly traded on their connections. Devon Archer has so far cancelled his scheduled depositions three times, but still intends to speak to the committee. They go on recess for the summer break in August. The New York Post has also covered the same story and tells us more. Devon Archer is expected to tell the committee, "Joe spoke to Hunter Biden's business associates, including those at Burisma, at least 24 times. Devon Archer and another business associate, Tony Bobulinski, have both said Joe Biden offered brief greetings and platitudes rather than concrete agreements to Hunter Biden's business partners. But Devon Archer's testimony will further challenge the White House's insistence that Joe Biden never had any knowledge or involvement of his wayward son's business affairs. James Comer, a Republican for Kentucky, who serves as the committee chairman, said, "We're looking forward very much to hearing from Devon Archer about all the times he had witnessed Joe Biden meeting with Hunter Biden's overseas business partners when he was vice president, including on speakerphone." Joe Biden, who was vice president from 2009 to 2017, spoke to Hunter Biden's partners on the Ukrainian energy firm Burisma in December of 2015. Hunter Biden and Devon Archer were in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Archer will reportedly testify, and Hunter Biden told fellow Burisma board members they could speak to his father on the phone. Hunter Biden connected his father with Mykola Zolochevsky, Burisma's owner, and Vadim Pozharsky, a senior Burisma executive. And while they gathered around the phone, Hunter Biden told his father, Joe Biden, that the Ukrainian businessman needs our support. Devon Archer is also expected to say that Joe Biden only spoke vaguely during the brief telephone call to greet the two businessmen. James Comer, a Republican from Kentucky, and the committee are interested in the communications because at the time Joe Biden was serving as President Barack Obama's point person on Ukraine and U.S. efforts to discourage corruption. The Washington Examiner has also covered the same story and tells us more. Burisma Holdings Limited, a holding company for a group of energy exploration and production companies, was being investigated for corruption. And in an email to Hunter Biden and Devon Archer in November of 2015, 1 month before the speaker phone call, Pozharsky demanded that they use their influence to close down the criminal investigation against Burisma. The paper said, Devon Archer will also tell the committee about a dinner at a restaurant in the French capital, Paris, where Hunter Biden took out his phone and called his father in a bid to impress potential investors. Devon Archer will say that Hunter Biden would introduce his father to the people on speakerphone in about one in four calls. At other times, he would speak to his father without telling him he was on speakerphone, leaving open the possibility that Joe Biden did not know his son was trading off his access. Joe Biden is known to speak to his son and his grandchildren regularly. Hunter Biden in 2021 told CBS News they speak every night. A close associate of Archer said he is testifying about his time working with Hunter Biden because he believes it is his civic duty. Devon Archer was sentenced to 1 year and a day in prison in February of 2022 for defrauding a Native American tribal entity and various investment advisory clients of tens of millions of dollars in connection with the issuance of $60 million in bonds. Devon Archer's associate said he felt the fraud case was a way to silence him. The source said he has nothing to hide, no revenge to enact, nor anyone to protect other than his family, and he feels he has been handcuffed by the absurdly bogus fraud case into remaining silent. The committee recently heard from two IRS whistleblowers, Gary Shapley and Joseph Ziegler, who both said that Hunter Biden had been given preferential treatment by the Justice Department. Hunter Biden agreed a plea deal for lying on his tax returns. He also agreed a deal over charges of lying on a gun permit application. He said he did not use drugs when he has admitted to addiction. During a recent hearing of the committee, firebrand Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene raised eyebrows when she shared explicit images of Hunter Biden with notorious women taken from his laptop. The Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene warned parents watching at home before her time questioning IRS whistleblowers that discretion is advised. The shocking moment went out on the C-SPAN live stream as well as other cable network channels airing the hearing, including Fox News Channel.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a very interesting and significant question. Before we do that, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners, because as you know, today marks the anniversary of the martyrdom and the death of the fourth Imam of the family of the Prophet, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam. And in general, as you know, we are in the month of Muharram. This is a very sad month, a very solemn month. It is the month in which, as you know, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and some of his choicest companions and some of his closest relatives were martyred in cold blood on the plains of Karbala in their opposition to the tyrannical policies and rule and unjust government of their time. In this connection, we want to ask, what is the qualifications of the Imam? And what are, according to Islam, and what are the characteristics and features which a person must have in order for him to rule justly and be rightfully deserve the ruler, the government, and the, you know, the rule of the Muslim Ummah? In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from the verses of the Holy Quran. As you know, if you are acquainted with the Quran and you've read it, you probably know that the Quran recounts the stories of the prophets. One prophet in particular that it talks about is the prophet Abraham. And God mentions the various trials and tribulations that Abraham went through. For example, he was ordered to leave his family in Mecca, in a barren land where there was nobody there. He was ordered to, later on, he was ordered to kill his son, sacrifice his son. And other things, he was thrown in the fire of Nimrud. He was asked to be patient at that. And all of these various trials and tribulations that the prophet Abraham went through. In one verse of the Holy Quran, God says the following, that after Abraham went through all of these trials and tribulations, God said, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, he said the following to him, وَإِذَبْتَلَىٰ إِبْرَاهِيمَ رَبُّهُ بِكَلِمَاتٍ فَأَتَمَّهُنَّ God says, and when his Lord tested Abraham with certain words, and he put him through certain trials and tribulations, and he fulfilled them, he said, قَالَ إِنِّي جَاءِلُكَ لِلنَّاسِ إِمَامًا I am making you the Imam of mankind. Right? So this kind of alludes to one of the characteristics of the Imam. He should be patient in the face of hardships, the trials and tribulations that that Allah puts him through. In this connection, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is reported as having said, surely Allah Blessed and Most High took Abraham as a slave before he took him as a prophet. And verily he took him as a prophet before he took him as an apostle. And verily he took him as an apostle before he took him as a friend. And verily Allah took him as a friend before he made him an imam. And when all of these ranks came together in him, he said, I am making you the imam of mankind. Okay? So this, you know, hadith and also this Quranic verse, it alludes to the fact that this imamat, this rule, is something higher than all of these other stations, right? And that shows that it cannot, it's not simply a managerial function, a worldly position, right? That doesn't require any kind of knowledge or any kind of infallibility or immaculateness from sin, right? Contrary to what a lot of the Islamic denominations and theological sects within Islam, they adhere to. They say that leadership of the ummah is simply a function. It's just like a worldly function, just like a person, and they actually say, a lot of them say that it's like a cook, right, who has to have expertise in cooking. He should know the different ingredients he should mix in order to make a certain dish. But that doesn't require him to be, infallible or have knowledge of Islamic rulings and so on and so forth, right? These verses of the Holy Quran and these hadiths, the examples of which we've just mentioned, kind of negate such a claim and such an assumption. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the qualifications of the just, rightful ruler in Islam in the light of the Quranic verses. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, grief and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. In today's episode, we are talking about grief and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, when we go into the lands of Karbala on the 10th of Muharram, in the year 61 Hijri, of course, we find that on the 10th of Muharram, at least 72 of the companions and family members of Imam Hussein alayhi salam were martyred. They lost their lives. They were murdered and killed on the plains of Karbala. They attained the glorious state of martyrdom in the defense of Islam and in the defense of Islamic lifestyle and Islamic values. And so the loss of 72 individuals that are beloved to an individual is really, it causes grief. But we find that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he did grieve. Unfortunately, there is a misguided trend to say that there was no grief in Imam Hussein alayhi salam at the martyrdom of these individuals. Now, there are different kinds of grief. We're not saying that Imam Hussein alayhi salam grieved due to the loss of some material ownership that he had. We're not saying that he grieved, you know, over some kind of a worldly grief, you know. So, for example, we lose some money in the stock market, well, we grieve, right? Or we got into an accident and our car got messed up, we grieve, right? No, this is not the kind of grief that we are talking about when it comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he had love for his companions. He had love for his family members. And all of these individuals, apart from being his companions and his family members, they were his responsibility. He was the Imam. And so as an Imam, he had an intense love for these individuals. And to lose such faithful and loyal companions on one hand does bring about grief.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alaykum.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. We're talking about grief and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We said, yes, it is saddening and it does bring about grief to lose a loved one and to lose somebody who is near to one. One of the things, though, that we find here when it comes to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and this grief which he faced, which was a colossal grief, it was tremendous to lose followers who loved him so dearly much, to lose these individuals, to see them in pain, to see them suffering, to see their thirst, to see, you know, their wounds. Imam Hussein was a human being. And so these things were very difficult to bear. But what made this grief bearable? What did not allow this grief to turn into despair or hopelessness or anger or hatred for that matter? Well, it was this idea that these individuals were standing up for Islam, they were defending Islam, and in the defense of Islam, they incurred these difficulties and these hardships. And it was in the defense of Islam that they incurred this kind of suffering, if you will.
But unlike worldly suffering, this suffering which comes about, or this hardship, or this difficulty that comes about due to standing up for what is right and what is true and what is just, this is not really suffering. It is, in fact, something to be proud of. It is something which drives and motivates an individual. It is this which will last on for forever, this difficulty that was faced in order to protect the religion of the Almighty Allah and to promote the religion of the Almighty Allah. It is this which helps an individual to overcome grief, meaning there's a greater purpose, there's an ultimate purpose, and that ultimate purpose is going to be accomplished via this means. Now, that is something that is a part of this natural world. It is something that cannot be avoided. And what better way to die than to sacrifice one's self for the sake of Islam in our Islamic lifestyle?
Again he looked at the horizon, the source were waiting for he.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. Silence, fill the air.
In the limelight.
In Britain, new research has shown that many people are currently facing worsening and in some cases catastrophic health impacts due to ongoing delays in healthcare. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A damning report warned thousands of patients in England are experiencing catastrophic health impact as a result of vital NHS appointments, procedures or operations being delayed or cancelled. A record 7.5 million people are waiting to start routine hospital treatment, the highest figure since records began back in 2007. About 385,000 people have now been waiting more than a year to start their NHS treatment. A devastating report by Health Watch England, a watchdog, says the last-minute cancellations were causing patients to get even sicker and their mental health to deteriorate. It found some in severe pain have endured multiple cancellations and postponements. In 2022-2023, there were 77,266 last-minute cancelled operations for people waiting for pre-planned care in hospitals in England. Meanwhile, separate figures show that strikes over the past 8 months have led to 819,000 appointments, operations and procedures being postponed. The report published on Thursday, 27th of July, came a day after junior doctors in England announced a fresh round of strikes in August, which could lead to tens of thousands of more treatments being either delayed or cancelled. The British Medical Association, the BMA, said junior doctors in England would stage a 4-day strike amid the continuing row with the government over pay, Thousands of new doctors will be urged to strike just over a week after starting work in England's hospitals. The strike will begin at 7 a.m. local time on 11th of August. A survey for the Health Watch report found that more than a third, or 39% of people who had an appointment called off this year experienced cancellations or postponements two or more times. Approximately 1,084 adults in England who had an appointment cancelled in 2023 were polled by Yonder Data Solutions on behalf of Health Watch. They included people who faced postponements for pre-planned hospital care, hospital outpatient appointments, diagnosis scans or tests, and community health appointments. Nearly 1 in 5 or 18% said their appointments were cancelled at the last minute, either on the day or as they arrive for their appointment. About 66% said cancellations to care had an impact, reporting continuing pain, worsening symptoms, worsening mental health, and disrupted sleep, among other problems. Half, or 52%, said they had not been offered support to manage their medical condition during the new wait for care, and 79% said the National Health Service had offered them very little or no support with their mental health. Health Watch said some groups appeared to be disproportionately affected by the cancellations. They include unpaid carers, neurodivergent people, those on lower incomes, and people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Louise Ansari, the chief executive of Health Watch England, said the findings of our research show that many people are currently facing worsening and, in some cases, catastrophic health impacts due to ongoing delays to care. Louise Ansari continued, and addressing health inequalities continues to be a significant challenge for the National Health Service. She added, people who often face serious difficulties accessing specialist NHS care, such as unpaid carers, neurodivergent people and those on lower incomes, are also those who are suffering the most from ongoing cancellations. She added, if their symptoms worsen or their mental health deteriorates, this in turn puts extra pressure on health and care services. We urgently need to reduce the number of cancellations of appointments, especially last-minute cancellations, and greater action is needed to address widening health inequalities. She added, with industrial action in the National Health Service being one of the many factors impacting people's ability to access timely health care, we're also renewing our call for all parties to reach a resolution to mitigate the impact of strikes on patients. An NHS England spokesperson said strikes over the past 8 months had obviously had a significant impact, but claimed that staff were doing all they could to manage the disruption. National broadcaster ITV has also covered the same story. Radiographers at 37 National Health Service trusts in England are going on strike as the pay row with the government continues. Members of the Society of Radiographers have voted to reject the government's 5% pay award and called for talks to reopen after other public sector workers, including junior doctors, were offered more. The union said worrying numbers of staff are leaving the profession and not enough is being done to recruit more workers. The 48-hour strike will run from 8 a.m. local time on Tuesday, 1st of August, and will involve the 35 NHS trusts where members have a mandate to strike. These include the Royal Marsden Cancer Hospital in London, University College London Hospitals, Liverpool University Hospitals, Nottingham University Hospitals, University Hospitals, Bristol and Western, and Sheffield's Teaching Hospitals. The Society of Radiographers said 9 out of 10 NHS patients are supported by radiographers who carry out X-rays, magnetic resonance imaging and CT scans, ultrasounds and breast screening, as well as radiotherapy for cancer patients. 1 million people are waiting for radiography. Dean Rogers, Executive Director of Industrial Strategy and Member Relations for the Society of Radiographers, said, "Voting for strike action was a difficult decision for our members who care above all about the safety and well-being of their patients." Dean Rogers added, "We need to draw attention to the fact that many radiography professionals are feeling burnt out by low pay and increased working hours. They're leaving the National Health Service and they're not being replaced in adequate numbers." Dean Rogers added, "If the government wants to reduce NHS waiting lists and ensure that patients receive the treatment that they need when they need it, then it must urgently prioritise the recruitment and retention of radiography professionals. And that means talking to us about our pay and conditions." He said, "But they're refusing to talk to us even though our door is open. Our members deserve better. Our patients deserve better." Health and Social Care Secretary Steve Barclay said, "I want to see an end to disruptive strikes so the National Health Service can focus relentlessly on cutting waiting lists and delivering for patients." Dr. Win Diwakar, the National Health Service Medical Director for Secondary Care, said, "Figures show that impact of industrial action is having on patients and families, and the scale of disruption is likely to be even greater, with many services avoiding scheduling appointments for the strike days." Dr. Vin Diwakar said, "We have now seen 765,000 appointments needing to be rescheduled in the last 8 months because of strikes, and we are continuing to see a significant cumulative impact on National Health Service services, as well as our hardworking staff, as they do all they can to maintain safe patient services while tackling a record backlog."
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The viewpoints of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the tragedy of Karbala. Blood gained a victory over the sword on the day of Ashura, and Zainab al-Kubra was the cause of that victory. This was because the forces of righteousness were apparently defeated in a military fight in Karbala, but Zainab al-Kubra's behavior was the factor that turned this apparent defeat into a permanent and decisive victory. That victory was due to the role she played after the day of Ashura. That is a very important point. The event proved that women are not on the periphery of history. It proved that women can have a central role in important historical events. This has been pointed out in several places in the Holy Quran as well. But Zainab al-Kubra is a recent example and does not belong to ancient times. The story of her life is a tangible event. She played a brilliant role, making the enemies, who had apparently won the battle and slain all their opponents, feel humiliated in their own base.
Ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana mazlum Hussein, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
She branded them with permanent disgrace and turned their victory into a defeat. That was what Zainab al-Kubra did. She proved that it is possible to turn feminine morality and modesty into glory and a great jihad. The greatness of Zainab al-Kubra's movement is reflected in what is left of her sermons. Her unforgettable sermon in Kufa's marketplace was not just an ordinary speech. It was not just the personal opinion of an important figure. Her sermon was a great and beautifully worded analysis of the Islamic community situation at that time. The sermon included the most profound Islamic concepts. See how strong her character was. Her brother, her imam and leader, had been martyred in a desert just 2 days before. Her dear ones, her children, and many of the other people had been martyred. She and tens of other women and children were taken captive on the same day. They were paraded in different places. Some of the people who were watching them were cheerful and some were shedding tears. Zainab al-Kubra suddenly started a great mission in that critical situation.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Multipolar world and invasive security were the main headlines of the talks that Russian President Vladimir Putin held with African leaders. Other issues were also discussed in the summit, including the food security. Withdrawal from the grain deal with Ukraine will allow Russia to accelerate the research of relations with African states. The food issue is exactly what the authorities can cling on to restore the ties lost after the collapse of the USSR. Representatives of African countries see Russia as a reliable partner, and thanks to this, Moscow has a good chance to firmly gain a foothold on the continent again. Putin has repeatedly stressed that Russia is ready to work together, hand in hand with African friends, to work for the future, to build a truly strategic interaction and partnership.
In the coming months, in the next 3 to 4 months, we will be ready to provide Burkina Faso, Zimbabwe, Mali, Somalia, the Central African Republic, Eritrea, with 50,000 tons of grain and fertilizer free of charge, and we will also provide free delivery of these products to consumers.
Moscow has once again written off $23 billion as part of African debt relief, implementing energy projects in 30 African countries, and is ready to settle accounts with African countries in national currencies. The descendants of prominent African leaders announced the creation of the Pan-African Anti-Colonial Legacy Forum. Among them are the descendants of Nelson Mandela, Gamal Abdel Nasser, Ahmed Ben Bella, Julius Nyerere, Samora Machel. New branches of Russian universities will be opened in Africa together with the enrollment increase of African students in Russian universities.
Russia has delayed its return to Africa. We should have done this earlier, especially since Moscow has such a good heritage in Africa. In Soviet times, Moscow has always supported liberation movements in Africa, supported humanitarian and economically. The USSR built a lot in Africa, developed a huge number of projects. After the USSR collapse, Russia was deceived in its choice of a pro-Western vector. The result is the expansion of NATO countries by its the border. Moscow is once again resuming its relations with Africa countries when the grain deal is completed and African countries again nations help.
The Russia-Africa summit was attended by representatives of those countries and presented the majority of the African.
With Russia's strong return, opportunity to completely get rid of Western colonial and also now tap into their natural resources and benefit from Russian experience in various fields such as security, agriculture and energy to fuel the growth of their countries. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol celebrated the 70th anniversary of the signing of the Korean War Armistice, honoring veterans of the war visiting Busan for the event. President Yoon again emphasized the importance of the country's alliance with the United States.
South Korea, as a responsible member of the international community, will stand in solidarity with free democratic countries. Also, with the South Korea-U.S. alliance as the linchpin, will protect peace, freedom, and prosperity of not only the Indo-Pacific region, but the whole world.
Still, many see President Yoon's strengthening of the alliance, resumption of large-scale military drills, and deployments of U.S. nuclear-capable ships and aircraft creating a barrier between North Korea and South Korea. North Korea remains under U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions over its missile and nuclear programs. Sanctions which critics say only hinder the country's economic development. Near the border with North Korea, NGO leaders from around the world called for the armistice to be replaced with a peace treaty.
We are here because after 70 years, the Korean people deserve peace. We are here because people around the world need to hear more about the impacts today of this ongoing war, including the very real human impacts. We believe that sanctions and pressure will not resolve the situation, but instead we need dialogue and cooperation.
North Korea, meanwhile, this week celebrated the armistice as a victory over the U.S. and South Korea, as congratulatory delegations from China and Russia visited Pyongyang.
The fortified border of the DMZ is just a few kilometers along National Road Number 1 behind me, across Unification Bridge. Despite the cycles of military tension, these symbols suggest there are many people in South Korea, likely North Korea, and around the world that remain optimistic about efforts toward peaceful relations. Frank Smith, Paju, South Korea.
In the midst of Iraq's 1980s war on Iran, the terrorist Mujahideen Khalq organization, a key ally of Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime, launched a brutal attack to overthrow the Islamic establishment in Iran. The attack that took place on July 26, 1988, was the Saddam regime's last attempt
to score gains after the Iraqi forces failed to capture even an inch of the Iranian territory during almost 8 years of war. Saddam's regime and the MEK came up with a ferocious blitz aimed at infiltrating from the central western borders of Iran into Kermanshah province. It meant to capture the capital, Tehran, execute the political leadership, and announce a power grab before Iranian reinforcement troops could be